Enjoying the program and
yes.
Things going good.
Right.
Thank God terrorism went down, but we had a share of rain, so no. Thank God it's not the same problem.
But rain, you know, we need the rain.
We do need the rain. That's very true. Because we have 6 months with no rain at all here. Absolutely no rain at all. So when we have torrential rain, we're all very very grateful. Yeah, so the topic I was asked to address is a topic that really needs much, much more time than we're able to give to it, but it's kind of some conflicts between Judaism and science, particularly cosmology and age of the universe, and issues like dinosaurs, and how many years have there been human beings in the world. And obviously there are many findings of modern science that on one level seem to contradict the biblical account, and on one hand we believe the Bible is from God, and the question therefore is how can it be true if scientific realities kind of move the other way. So I'm just going to give you a few perspectives on this, and I want to make a point. I have to give you a disclaimer that I am not speaking for Orson Meach, or I'm not speaking for all rabbis. I'm just giving you an approach that I myself find helpful, and I believe it is within the framework of being a religious Jew. But as I say, some of my colleagues might differ. And again, that's one of the nice things. You have to understand that even within halachic Judaism, there is not always a monolithic approach to things. I think that is important. We are not, well, we're fundamentalists in the sense that we believe in the divine origin of the Torah, but you will see that there is often not a monolithic interpretation on the values of Jewish law. Yeah.
I've heard that, on the Mabul, they've never actually found any. Be able to do testing to see if water hit certain type of rocks on the top of the highest mountains.
Yeah.
They never saw any fish or any information that would show that it was submerged in water ever.
Well, once again, I'll give you an example of how one might approach this from a rational standpoint. And that is.
I heard someone else talk about it. So.
Yeah. I'm going to talk about some other issues, but part of it is that we are not obligated to assume that the Mabul was a worldwide phenomenon. The Mabul wiped out the human race, but the human race itself could have been concentrated in a relatively small area. So we don't necessarily have to make the claim that the whole world was covered with water. If the human race itself was confined to a relatively small, that would be like one possible way of analyzing it.
It doesn't talk about the tallest mountain.
It could be the tallest mountain in that particular area. I mean, listen, Mount Ararat. Even if you identify it as Mount Ararat in Turkey, there is actually such a mountain peak. Is very far from being the tallest mountain. I mean, Mount Everest is a lot bigger. And the like. So you're really dealing with you know, where human beings were concentrated and the like. But I first want to start with a general perspective, which really does not answer anything specific, but it is a general thing to be aware of, and that is, what is the goal of the Torah? You know, why did God give us a Torah? Why do we have a Torah? So the truth of the matter is, the purpose of the Torah is not to give us a scientific account of creation. The Torah is not about physics. It's not about biology. It is not about anything scientific. Science describes how things happened. And whatever it is, whether it's Big Bang or whatever your theory, but science cannot describe why things happened. And the Torah is about morality. It is about a purpose, that creation is purposeful. Creation is teleological, to use a more fancy term, meaning it was goal-directed. And what you have to walk away when you read Genesis is not so much how God created the world. The Torah is not even giving you all the details there. But that God created the world, and therefore the world has purpose and the like. So in many, many ways, to say that there are conflicts between science and religion is literally an apples and oranges type of problem, because science is dealing with one set of problems and religion is dealing with another set of problems. Science is dealing with the mechanics and the laws and the principles which operate through the natural world. The Torah is dealing with what you might call ultimate purpose, an ultimate goal. And an honest scientist will tell you that those are not scientific questions. In other words, why the Big Bang happened at a given moment, that's beyond science. That is not within the realm of science. So the net result here is this. Obviously, we have to understand the particular texts. But in many, many ways, a God-centered Judaism can accommodate virtually any type of scientific understanding as long as one accepts the premise that God was the architect of the action. So, for example, evolution is not intrinsically against Judaism, as long as one regards God as orchestrating the process for a certain purpose. Now, again, obviously you're going to have problems. How will certain verses be understood? But nevertheless, you know, there's plenty of ways of interpreting things. You know, it's like, that is why, for example, Judaism historically has had much less problems with science versus religion than the Catholic Church. You know, the Catholic Church, for centuries, have been persecuting various scientific discoveries that they thought were antagonistic to the Bible and to their religious tradition. Even someone like Copernicus, right? So Copernicus tried to establish, or did establish, that the Earth goes around the Sun instead of the other way around. And that was thought to be against the Bible, that teaches that the Earth is the purpose of all of creation. Copernicus was persecuted, as you know. Galileo was forced to engage in a fake recantation of his beliefs and the like. Judaism, however, has been much more flexible in the sense that, yeah, we can go with this, we can go with that, we can go with that. Meaning, to mix my metaphors, we can be very agnostic, not about God, but we can be very agnostic regarding the truth and falsity of any number of scientific theories because we can accommodate them. In short, you know, if God is infinite, God has an infinite amount of tools in his toolbox by which he could create and orchestrate the natural world. So science is interesting, and of course I do want to point out, I don't know if Rabbi Gottlieb spoke to you about this, you know, he goes through a lot of the science, and again, I'm not suggesting that science is like infallible and we got to kind of figure out how to fit the Torah to science. Scientific theories have plenty of holes in them, and one should examine all scientific claims with a great deal of skepticism. But all I'm saying is, Judaism does not rise or fall on the acceptability of any particular scientific theory. We can live with evolution, we can live with the age of the earth, I'll discuss how we live with it. You know, we can live with all sorts of things because simply the Torah is not about the scientific account of creation at all. That is not even an interest of the Torah. Per se, the Torah is about morality, it is about purpose, it is about God's presence in the natural universe. You know, some of you might have read as kids the first Sherlock Holmes novel, A. Conan Doyle, I think it was A Study in Scarlet. So I remember, just as a kid, I just remember for some reason this one little passage remains in my head, where Watson is talking to Holmes, and at some point it turns out that Holmes was not aware of Copernicus, meaning Holmes still thought that the sun rotated or revolved around the earth. So Watson says to Holmes, you know, Holmes, you're such a brilliant person, how could it be that you're not aware of Copernicus? So Holmes basically said, in my line of work, it really doesn't make a difference. And it really makes no difference in what I do, whether the sun goes around the earth or the earth goes around the sun, it's just irrelevant. So in many, many ways, I'm not saying that it's good to be scientifically illiterate, but in many, many ways, it, for religious purposes, it almost makes no difference. We are not as troubled as the Catholic Church with these so-called heresies. We can live with them, we can incorporate them, we can deal with them, at the same time recognizing that they themselves are fallible and limited. Moreover, let me just give you one very interesting example. If one penetrates into science at a deeper level, one actually sees the amazing idea that within the complexity and multiplicity of natural phenomena, there are fundamental basic laws that explain billions and billions of things. Now, we know that physics has kind of reduced all of the operations of the universe to around three or four basic laws. And as you know, the so-called, forgive my Christian metaphor, the so-called holy grail of physics is the theory of everything, the so-called unified field theory that Einstein devoted around 30 years of his life to trying to get, and he didn't quite get, and people are still working on this. And there is a strong intuitive sense among scientists that there is a unifying structure that explains the universe. Now, if you think about that, if the universe does not have a creator, if there is no guiding intelligence, why would there be a unified structure? Meaning, say, in many ways, even the agnostic atheist scientists, like a Stephen Hawking himself. I mean, what's going on? From where comes this search for the elegant, unified field theory that unites all phenomena, if indeed the world is, the universe is a product of random chaos? Why are human beings hardwired to search for unity within diversity, to search for order within chaos? Why would there even be an a priori assumption that there would be order unless there is some conscious force that is ordering? One wonders from where comes this impulse within a scientist, within every person really, to find order in the universe. But let me give you a very, very striking example. And again, if those of you that have strong physics backgrounds, please forgive my relative ignorance, because you're probably much more conversant than I am, but I'll give you a very simplistic layperson's analysis of some things. We know that classical physics is basically Newtonian physics, right? Isaac Newton, great guy. By the way, you should know, even Isaac Newton invented within 18 months, you know, he developed the theories of gravity and optics and calculus. So all of those high school seniors can blame Isaac Newton or Leibniz. They both discovered it at the same time for inventing calculus. But you know, all of these scientific things were really Newton's hobby. Do you know what Newton's real passion was? Newton's real passion was biblical interpretation. He actually wrote thousands of commentaries, pages of commentaries on the Bible. He really was, and he had to keep it secret because it was against Anglican doctrine. It was a bit of a heretic in his biblical interpretation, but that was his great, great passion. But what is Newtonian physics? That's called classical physics. So Newtonian physics is largely what we call a deterministic system, meaning if the same force is applied to the same object and all other factors are equal, you will get the same result every time. It is predictable, it is stable, it is deterministic. Now, obviously, things change because not all things are equal, but the whole predicate of Newtonian determinism is equal force on equal object will always produce an equal result. This is called a deterministic system, and it is the basis of the notion of scientific laws. Now, it was discovered in the beginning of the 20th century, one of the great revolutions in science, the concept of quantum mechanics, in which it was discovered that indeed subatomic particles will sometimes behave in different and unpredictable ways and do not necessarily follow a rigid deterministic model of laws. Right, this was Einstein initially uncovered some of these things. He later repudiated it because Einstein did not want to believe what was his famous statement, God does not play with dice, etc. So Einstein repudiated, but then you have Niels Bohr. Again, the early decades of the 20th century were really a phenomenal period in this discovery of this whole notion that the universe is unstable, the universe is unpredictable, that on the subatomic level, these crazy particles are like chickens without a head. They're just running around, and you can't really predict. And the whole notion of scientific law was called into question, that you don't have scientific laws. All you have are probabilities of what probably will happen under a given condition. Now, and quantum mechanics or quantum physics has been accepted as an accurate description of how the world works. So if you ask a physicist, which is correct, Newtonian determinism or quantum mechanics?
They both are.
A physicist will tell you they're both correct. That's exactly what he'll say. Oh, they're both right. And the way it might be described in a grossly simplistic way is that Newtonian physics continues to govern big things. Obviously, you know, I push over a table, you know, it's always going to respond the same way. In fact, if you simply lived in a purely quantum universe, you know, I wouldn't want to go on an airplane if there was simply a probability that, you know, the thrust will keep the plane up and the like. I mean, the world depends on the notion of stability, predictability, and the like. So a physicist will say, well, quantum mechanics governs the subatomic universe, so to speak. But big things, tables, chairs, computers, cars, airplanes, rockets, you know, Newton is totally fine for that. Now, the problem is, on some superficial level, this makes no sense, because big things are nothing more than aggregates of small things. So if on the small level everything is unpredictable, and probabilistic, how does it become predictable on the big level? And again, there was some amazing idea that every deviation is compensated by another deviation in the other way. So the whole thing like stays together, even though this is going here, but they kind of balance each other out. Now, and again, that's why I'm saying when you listen to physicists today, they sound like mystics. They sound more like Kabbalah than science. But that's the nature of the beast. This is the amazing complexity, elegance, beauty, and even simplicity of the structures that are created here. Now, I want to point out the following. This is just really a very striking example. There is a famous Midrashic saying that God looks into the Torah and created the universe. You probably have heard that either here or even before you got here. That is, in many ways, the Torah was the blueprint, which means you would expect to see in the physical world echoes and mirrors and reflections of deep spiritual truth. I would like to suggest to you that the seeming contradiction or tension between quantum mechanics and Newtonian deterministic physics is reflective of a deep spiritual question that exists regarding human free will. That is, you know, it's axiomatic, and I'm sure you've discussed this extensively, that God gave human beings free will. That's very fundamental. Unlike Calvinists or even early Islamic philosophers who believed that man's moral choices were predetermined, and in fact, Islamic philosophy initially took the position that if man had free will, that would be a contradiction to divine omnipotence. Divine omnipotence means God is almighty. How can you decide to do something against God? So it got to be that God made you bad or made you good. But Maimonides convincingly argues that the whole basis of moral accountability has to be predicated on free will. Because if I'm programmed that I have to behave evil,
why would I feel bad?
Why would I feel bad? And how could God punish me? How could God hold me accountable? And conversely, if I do good just because I'm programmed, where's the virtue?
Yeah.
And how could repentance be possible? And how could you change? And how could you grow? So Maimonides says it is axiomatic that human beings have free will. Now again, this is a complicated notion, because even though we have free will, that doesn't mean the scope of our free will is going to be the same in every situation. If I'm a drug addict in the throes of heroin addiction, we're not going to say I have free will to go to the Ursa Meir Yeshiva and become a full-time, you know, Baal Tshuva.
Not as much.
But there's always a fulcrum of choice, meaning to say the drug addict could have checked himself in. And there's, the choice is at the fork. There's always a fork in the road, meaning maybe God is not going to hold me accountable for not being there at that stage in my life, but he's going to hold me accountable for not being here instead of here. There's always going to be that fulcrum, that tipping point of choice, right? So my mind, and by the way, I don't want to get into all of the free will issues, but you know that one of the great free will questions comes out of these Torah readings, when it says God hardened Paro's heart, meaning even if Paro wanted to let him go, yeah, God like made him say no, and then he punishes the Egyptians with all of these plagues, and that's the whole question, exactly, how do you reconcile that with free will? Yeah.
I heard of Joshua that he was just like so bad that at that point God just said, I mean, that's why we call him Pharaoh. We don't give him a name. He was just so bad that,
well, Pharaoh was the name. All the kings of Egypt were called Pharaohs. It was a royal title.
Yeah, I know. But instead of just saying Pharaoh this or that, they heard children.
Yeah.
They all named him Pharaoh because they weren't like they were so bad that their name didn't even deserve to be in the Torah. Uh-huh. Even Amalek's
okay.
In the Torah.
Right.
So that's why.
Yeah, Maimonides seems to. Yeah, Maimonides does develop an interesting idea that sometimes a person's choosing evil can be so intense that at some point they lose their capacity for free will, but it's because of the choices they made earlier, meaning they choose to rebel, they eventually, it's as if they become addicted. They become addicted to evil in a way that they can't break out of it, but it was a consequence of their own choices. But here is the question I want to raise, and this is going to be the connection to physics, you'll see in a moment. That is, one of the big questions that free will raises is the notion that God has a plan for the universe. God, nothing happens without God's will. And we don't always understand the will. We don't understand why was there a Holocaust. There are a lot of things we don't understand. But it is a belief in Judaism that God is directing the course of history to a predetermined end, hopefully culminating in the Messiah and the redemption. Now the problem is, how can you talk about God directing the course of human events if every individual, billions of these actors, make their own decisions free of any divine interference based on free will? It's kind of a dilemma. Like, how can God have an overall plan for how many billions? 13 billion? How many people in the world? 13 billion, yeah. How can God direct the overall movement of 13 billion people if every one of those 13 billion people, or at least, you know, not everyone, but I guess some are, so it's whatever, are making their own decisions? I don't have an answer to that, but all I can tell you is it's exactly reflected in the tension between Newtonian determinism and quantum mechanics. Because in the big picture, there is determinism, there is stability, there is predictability, even though the individual subatomic components are making their own decisions, so to speak. Those little particles, those little rascal particles. Right? So all I'm saying is that in the deep structures of physical reality are reflected the tensions and even the inconsistencies in free will. This is an illustration of God looking in the Torah and constructing the world as a hologram, as a reflection of the spiritual truths of the Torah.
How is the big picture predetermined in that way? Because it seems like, if anything, we're going down.
Well, again, that is a question. We don't understand the process. That much I think we're going to admit. But there is a concept that the evil that seems to be ascending in the world is treated as analogous to the death throes. You know, before a candle goes out, it has one last burst of energy. Before a human being dies, there's sometimes.
Yeah.
Right? So consequently, this is evil's last rise before the Mashiach. There's a teaching of the Vilna Gaon, and I'll get to the age of the earth in a moment, but no, we say that according to the Jewish calendar, we're in the year 5776. And according to the teachings of the rabbis, the Mashiach can come anytime, but he will come before the year 6000. So we're kind of in the last 200 or so years. So here's the thing. According to the Vilna Gaon, he makes the point that every millennium, every thousand years, corresponds to one day in the creation cycle. And therefore, just like after 6 days is the Shabbos, so after 6,000 years is the Shabbos, which is the Messianic.
Eternal rest.
Now, it's very, very fascinating. I have not worked this out, and Vilna Gaon does not tell us, but he claims that you should be able to correlate all of the historical events of every millennium with what God created on that day. That's very, very fascinating. What God created on day 6 day created man. You know.
In other words, this is the day, the millennium of human conflict.
That's correct. Perhaps that's so.
The God created man on the 6th day, right? So on the 6th day, in the 6,000th year, God will essentially create the Mashiach.
But remember, the year 6,000 is the beginning of the 7th millennium.
Right. So that's when Mashiach comes, we're going to have the ultimate Shabbat, the everlasting Shabbat. So essentially, you can think that the day that Mashiach is born, say it does happen, that we have to wait another 224 years, right? But that
time.
Will be the last year. This birth will be the age of the Mashiach. That's it. I actually came up with that idea before I heard that the Vilna Gaon and everybody came up with it over Sukkot. I was at a shir at a Rav's shul back in New York.
Yeah.
And I asked him. I was like, if it's a possible theory that since we're in the year 5000 and whatever right now, that each 1,000 years corresponds to.
Oh, wow. So,
the next Vilna Gaon.
Maybe you're related to the Vilna Gaon. You don't know.
Maybe you're Mashiach.
Could be.
Don't go there.
I was wondering, I read just something quickly online. I don't remember which rabbi it was specifically, but that he made some kind of prophecy regarding like 50 year cycles. Is it called like a jubilee or something like that? And how, you know, so like the Turks would, you know, he predicted several hundred years before that the Turks would rule over Jerusalem for eight jubilees, and they did. It was like exactly like 1517 to 1917.
Yep.
And then there was one.
There are. Now again, within the rabbinic and even mystical community, there are different views about trying to impose too much of a detailed timeline on this process. There are some rabbis who actually do it, and they like to point to different contemporary events and how they fit various biblical and mystical timelines. There are other rabbis, including Maimonides, who was very much against the process, because Maimonides basically said, you only understand these things in hindsight and not in foresight, meaning when the Messiah comes, we will then be able to look back and identify the various markers, but he felt it was not productive necessarily to do it before it happens, because there's all sorts of false starts. For example, I don't want to get too much off topic, but you know, the wars of Gog and Magog, by the way, the Christian term Armageddon is Greek for Gog and Magog. And Gog and Magog is described in the book of Ezekiel as the great apocalyptic wars that will occur before the coming of the Mashiach. We do have this belief that it'll be a very turbulent, the wars of Gog and Magog. But what are the wars of Gog and Magog? Some say, well, maybe it was the Holocaust. Or maybe it's the Arab-Israeli conflict. Or maybe it's Islamic fundamentalism. or maybe we haven't had it yet. There's an intriguing and scary, frightening passage from the Vilna Gaon, in which he wrote 250 years ago that the war of Gog and Magog will last 12 minutes. Now, 200 years ago, that made no sense at all. Somebody reads that and says, what type of war is going to last 12 minutes?
We know now.
Right?
So, well, that's only considering the fact of atomic weapons and etc.
That's right. That's exactly right. Meaning to say, I don't know if the Vilna Gaon identified atomic weapons or not.
But somehow he
understood. So what I'm saying is, we don't know what the War of Gog and Magog is, and moreover. Well, it can be bypassed. Now, the Talmud basically says that Gog and Magog is part of the normal process, but by good deeds and righteousness, you know, we can bypass some of that. The Vilna Gaon. I guess we can certainly spend days talking about the genius and the brilliance of the Vilna Gaon. Yeah.
That's why they call him the Gaon.
That's correct.
It was famous. It happened like last year. This person had a this young guy never learned a day in his life.
Yeah. I saw that video.
I did
see that. That was very interesting.
I have to tell you
quite honestly.
Yeah.
I may be totally wrong. I think it was a setup.
A lot of people.
I think the kid was fed what to say. It looked like he memorized.
It looked like he was being fed.
It looked like he memorized what to say.
You
and
know the kid that's really.
Yeah. The rabbi kept on prompting him. Remember this.
Remember this.
I was not. I mean, listen. What the kid said is largely true, because essentially what the rabbi fed him were statements.
Yeah.
From the Talmud and the Medrash. So, you know, so actually, what the kid said was true, but I personally don't believe that he experienced.
Obama was gold. Like,
no, that already. No,
that's already like.
Yeah,
like,
that's already different.
Yeah, like,
yeah.
How do you.
No.
What is this video?
No, this was a kid who, what was he? He was sick, he was an actor, and he claimed to have dreams and visions of the coming of the Mashiach and the redemption, and he was describing all sorts of things, but. And he was not religious at all.
You see the beginning of time to the end of time, like a movie. And
But my own impression, which I'm not saying is true, is that he was set up. Some rabbis just wanted to use him, and they gave him a lot of things that are in the Gemara.
Most of the stuff was in Kabbalah and stuff.
Right, but then when he starts saying Obama is Gog, I think at that point.
I heard people come and say like very, very similar things, but those are like real.
Yeah, that was my impression, because I actually listened to it, and I had the impression that the rabbis had. The kid liked the attention, and the rabbis gave him a lot of stuff.
The thing
to
is, that rabbi, like, if you know who that rabbi is, I'm sure you do. He was like a very, very high up general in the army. Never had anyone say anything about him. Never had a history of lying or anything like that. So a lot of people actually take his word for it based on his reputation for.
Okay,
so
you know, I might be wrong. Listen,
I don't know.
But I can tell you that even if the kid didn't have the vision, a lot of these things are going to happen. So the truth of the matter is, it's true whether the kid is telling the truth or not.
It could be Obama or it could be George Clooney. We don't know.
Yeah.
George Clooney.
Yeah. Now the thing is, of course,
he's been young for a long time.
A lot of Catholics say that this pope is going to be the last pope. You know, there's a lot of statements in the world that the world as we know it is kind of coming to an end. Things are going to change. A different order is going to emerge.
Or it's because a lot of people are just throwing out Christianity in general.
Yeah. Okay.
Like,
well.
In general, like, they've in the last 10 years, so many controversial things. I'm sure you know about.
Yeah.
Came up,
yeah.
And that made them just look so stupid.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. So now I just want to share with you one particular interesting passage of Kabbalah. You know, one of the major issues that people raise is age of the earth. Age of the earth, you know, I mean, we claim that the world is 5,000, the universe is 5,776 years old. And scientists say, what are you talking about? We have billions of years and the life.
We have carbon dating.
So carbon dating, etc. Dinosaurs, all sorts of things. So let me just give you something that was found in a Kabbalistic sefer, Kabbalistic book, that was written probably in the 1200s, a real, real long time ago. And this was resurrected by a great rabbi who died tragically young, Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. Perhaps you've heard of Rabbi Kaplan. He's written books on Jewish meditation. Mm-hmm. He was a great Kabbalist himself. And let me tell you that this is really will blow your mind. He says the following. He says, if you go, not he, he's quoting this book. If you go with the idea, and this is even before the Vilna Gaon, the Vilna Gaon said it as well, that every millennium, that the 6 days of creation correspond to a millennium. So here is what the Kabbalist Sefer says. In the Torah, there is a sabbatical cycle. You farm in Israel. You work the land for 6 years and you rest on the seventh year. In fact, last year was a Shemitah year. But you actually go through that cycle 7 times. Right? 6 and a Shemitah, 6 and a Shemitah, 6 and a Shemitah.
And then you
get the 50th year.
Is that where the Jubilee comes from?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
The 50th year. No, I'll explain. On the 50th year, you have what is called the Jubilee. And the Jubilee, now we don't practice Jubilee today because you need a temple, but when there was a Jubilee year, a lot of interesting things happened. Slaves went free.
Yeah.
All land went back to the ancestral owners. If land had been sold, Jubilee, it all goes back for nothing. And it's also like a Shemitah that you're not allowed to work the land and the like. So you have seven, so the seventh year is called the Shemitah year. So you have 7 Shemitah cycles. Mm-hmm. And then you follow with the Great Jubilee. So this Kabbalistic Sefer says the following. The same way that there are 7 Shemitah cycles, the earth itself, or the universe itself, will go through 7 cycles of 7,000 years. Meaning, when we say 6,000 years followed by Mashiach, it actually means 6,000 years followed by 1,000 years of Messianic perfection, and then the world graduates to a higher, more spiritual level in which you have another millennium, another cycle of 6 and 1,000.
So,
and that's going to repeat 7 times till you reach the ultimate perfection of the Jubilee. Now, according to this Sefer, it actually says the Torah itself will become more spiritual and more ethereal as we graduate. On our level, the Torah is largely physical. Don't eat meat and milk, etc. At a recreation on the next level, it will assume, the same letters will assume different configurations and different forms. Now, the question becomes, which cycle are we in? So, now here I don't have a source for this. I mean, the Sefer doesn't explain how it knows, but the Sefer asserts that we are in the 2nd cycle, that when we say this is 5,776, this is the 2nd cycle, and there was a 7,000 year cycle before us that predated the beginning of the Torah. Now, that doesn't seem to help you that much, so that's great. So instead of 5,776, you add another 7,000 years.
We're talking about billions.
No, so listen to this. Since the first cycle did not have an Adam and Eve, the first cycle is defined by God years rather than man years. What is a God year? Now, theoretically, it's infinite, but in the
Psalms... The amount of time it takes for God to rotate around the sun.
So in Psalms, you have a mechanical conversion table. King David says to God, 1,000 years in your eyes. It's like 1 day. That's the table. So if you look at it as a table, if 1 day of God is 1,000 man years, then 1 year of God is 365,000 man years. So 1 year of God. So multiply, if cycle number one, which is pre-Adam, is God years, and it's 7,000 years, 7,000 times 365,000 years. I don't have a calculator, but it's a pretty big number. Again, 365,000 times 7,000, that gets you at least several billion years. So as a result, even though it is true that this cycle of creation is may only be 5,775 years, but indeed, if you accept the statement of the Kabbalist that was written in the 13th century, that there was a God cycle of 7,000 years computed in God's years, you actually have an age of the earth that is surprisingly close.
Oh, is this the age of the earth or the age of the universe?
Age of the universe.
2.55.
Okay, billion. Okay.
Yeah. This is a little off topic, but according to many scientists, the sun will burn out in the future.
Yeah.
Now, if that happens, all human life will just disappear.
That's correct.
Yeah. Why would God let that happen?
Well, the answer is God may not let that happen. That's very true. But on the other hand, keep in mind the following. One can indeed speculate. See, we believe in a body and a soul. We believe your reality is your soul. You see? So the physical body is the means by which we can do good deeds and study Torah and bring merit to our soul, which ultimately unites with God. So the phenomenon of a physical universe winding down might just be reflective of the fact that once the mission has been accomplished, we become united with God as a single spiritual essence. So it's not like a punishment. It's not God's going to destroy it. It's the other way around. It's the physical world is a means to accomplishing certain goals. When those goals are accomplished, we have what is called Olam Haba. You see? Now, so those are all possibilities.
Okay, I have two questions. One is, what does the Torah believe in terms of like habiting other planets? Like, you know how we're like cultivating Mars and trying to go further than that?
You're not asking about life on other planets. You're asking about
that's
just
my second question.
Okay. No, it's living enough. Yeah. So it's a very interesting question. You know, it's really not clear to this day. It's not clear. There was some discussion when we went to the moon about that. You know, some interesting halakhic questions. Do you have to keep mitzvos if you're not on Earth? In other words, if I go to Mars, am I exempt from commandments, or even go to the moon?
How do you know when to pray?
How do you know when to pray? That's correct. You know, that's what Lisa said. That was the old joke about what did the Jewish astronaut do when he was going around the Earth. He says, Shachris Mincha Maariv the whole day. He had to daven the whole day because, And how do you keep Shabbos? Of course, by the way, I want to point out, a lot of these questions are not only other planets. A lot of these problems are, if you're at the North Pole. The problems are very much real problems on Earth, where the sun might not set for 6 months or vice versa. How do you compute Shabbos? How do you daven? Those are real, real difficult questions. So if you are exempt from commandments, the philosophy would be it is not proper for a Jew to put himself in an environment where he cannot keep the Torah. Now, whether there is life on other planets, I think is more of a difficult question. According to the Chazal and Maimonides, there was an idea that stars and planets actually had a form of intelligence.
Yeah.
But they were like angels. They were not free will, so to speak, but they had a consciousness of some sort. So there could very well be some intelligent life out there.
See, I was told by a rabbi in Toronto that he was saying that there's no other intelligent life form out there because we're the only ones given the Torah, therefore
yes.
we're the only
so,
ones...
So I would qualify, there is no other intelligent life force with moral free will.
With moral free will.
That's correct. In other words, Maimonides suggests there may be intelligence and consciousness, but it would be in the nature of artificial intelligence or a computer. In other words, some type of... we don't understand the concept, really, of intelligence without free will, but that's what an angel is. An angel is programmed to behave a certain way. I guess the closest analogy to our experience would be some type of robot that is programmed to respond, but there is no autonomy or free will. I think that is correct.
So according to the theory that that we have a cycle of Shemitah years
yes.
of the world.
Yes.
And yes. we're in our second quote unquote Shemitah year.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So we got another four more cycles of
that's correct. But they're man years. But those cycles are man years. Not once you have man, You're no longer, in other words, it's only the first cycle that is God year. The other cycles are
30,000 years.
Yeah, theoretically. Theoretically. Yeah, Dr. Shravi, correct. Yes,
30,000 years in exile.
Whoa. No, not exile. We'll have Mashiach by the year 6,000. And then there'll be 1,000 years of Mashiach, and then the world gets recreated in a good, higher way, meaning
What are we essentially then? Do we go back?
Well, we become progressively more angelic, progressively more spiritual. There will not be the exiles. Really, they're kind of the outgrowths of Mashiach. Mashiach brings the universe to a higher level, and then we function at a higher level.
That's the secondary question. Yeah. All of that. So, in the Messianic era, considering all the previous faults of man, Adam, Eve, kind,
yeah.
Is there, unless I hope that this will happen, or like, you know, it's just a theory, is there any possibility that the world could reset itself back to man like this? Can it degenerate?
The assumption is it will not degenerate. The assumption is that all of the struggles and failures of each stage of existence are going to be rectified by the time we come to a new stage. So there will always be struggles, but the struggles will operate at a higher level. Meaning, it'll be good versus better as opposed to good and evil.
In other words, we would have achieved the ultimate tikkun olam.
I think that's the case, yeah. Yeah.
Just kind of related to that question, so like, yeah, you said the world was, I guess, maybe potentially recreated.
Yeah.
Like if we're in the second cycle.
Right.
So when it was being, like when we read in the Torah about creation, is that after the 1,000 years of Mashiach that happened in the first cycle?
Yes, it seems so. And that really explains things like at the beginning of Genesis,
right,
it says the world was covered with water and the Spirit of God is hovering over the water. Remember that in the beginning of Genesis. Now the question is, well, what do you mean? God is creating everything now. What is this antecedent water?
Right.
The answer is, it's a remes, it's an allusion to the idea that there had been a prior creation that's now being recreated.
And just a second question, like with regards to how big the universe is, why would God concentrate all of intelligent life on, you know, such a small planet?
That is a good question, because we are literally less than a speck, right?
Right.
We are probably equivalent to a
pixel.
Right, is a pixel? I was going to say an atom, but you're saying okay.
More like atom.
I thought it was an atom, but okay, whatever it would be.
Discernible.
Yeah, we're really, it's an amazing thing. I don't know. I don't really have an answer, but I think maybe God wants to show that it's not quantity that matters, it's quality, and that's an important lesson, because we, the Jewish people themselves, you know, we are such a small nation. You know, it's very interesting. If you ask a typical non-Jew, maybe a lot of Jews, how many Jews are there in the world? They're going to say, 50 billion, you know, etc. You know, that's the thing about that. I don't want to get into politics about Islam, but people say, Muslims, what are you going against the Muslims? The vast majority of Muslims are peace-loving.
Vast majority of
nice people.
But there's like over a billion of them.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
What percentage do you want to say? 90% are good?
Well, I have an answer.
95% are good? 98% are good?
I took an introduction.
It's still going to be many more times than the Jewish people.
So I took an introduction to Islam class, and we had that discussion right at the beginning. And my Muslim prof was even willing to say, out of what, 7% is approximately the amount that would do
harm.
That aren't peace-loving necessarily.
Yeah.
A couple percent of those people who would actually,
that's
still a few million people.
Yes.
We're talking about the openly ones. We're not talking about the ones that are like considering it, but really just in their own.
That's what I'm saying.
That's a bigger number.
So if you compare the number of Jews in the world and the positive, I am not an anti-Muslim person at all. I mean, people should be judged as individuals. But all I'm saying is, when you're dealing with huge numbers like this, then even tiny percentages can be very, 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 very dangerous. It just happens to be the nature of the beast. But to put it in the positive way, if you look at the small number of the Jewish people, and you look at the positive impact that Jews have had in the world in so many ways, I think you do see that numbers don't really matter as much as you might think. And maybe that's the prototype of why God concentrated intelligent life in such a tiny little fraction of the universe. Okay, I'm sorry, I got to run, but one more question. Yeah.
Hypothetically speaking, the Torah is essentially a recording of the world from the beginning.
Yeah.
So, if we had this so-called Shemitah year, where the year that the world was reset, like you said, that God was hovering over the earth full of water.
Right.
Right. How come the Torah doesn't actually record a Mashiach prior to Adam and Eve?
Well, again, it's a good question, but what I think is...
It wasn't essential for us.
Yeah, the Torah's message is for this cycle of creation.
We're at a higher level.
So therefore, it begins with this cycle. It begins with where we are. It does not... In fact, the Talmud even has a reference, an enigmatic reference. It says, do not ask what came before, and do not ask what comes after. Meaning, there is a concept of the world or the universe before this one, the universe after this one, that's kind of beyond our ability to fully grasp. We have to focus on the here and now. But okay. Be it as it may, if you're interested in looking at this, the book is called The Age of the Universe, Rabbi Ari Kaplan, and you know he talks about.
Have you read the Signs of God?
I have heard saying it. Yeah. Now, again. I threw out just one little argument. You have Gerald Schroeder, right. Dr. Schroeder, who tries to show that based on relativity theory
of
time and space, it is possible for something to be simultaneously a lower number and a higher number at the same time, depending on how you measure
and
time.
He corresponds with the Big Bang.
That's correct. So Dr. Schroeder tries to reconcile it based on relativity of time-space. So there's a great deal of writing. I gave you one very quickie approach, although it's a very very deep approach. But there are more involved scientific theories that if you have a good physics background, you can read Dr. Schroeder's books, and he goes through it.
So would dinosaur bones be from the first...
Right, so this would be the thesis, that some of these things with carbon dating might exist from the prior cycle.
Okay.
And therefore, there was never a time... Now, there is one other question, which I don't have time, maybe I'll mention tomorrow quickly, and that is, okay, so the age of the Earth, we have a pretty good possible answer for, but the age of man is still going to be a problem, because Homo sapien... Because no matter what, you cannot deny that the Jewish tradition does teach that man, Adam, the first man, is only 5,776 years old. And I think science does not put man billions of years old, but it puts him at least 50,000. No, I don't think so. I think maybe 10,000 years old. It's not a huge difference. But it's maybe 50,000, maybe 50,000 years old.
What Dr. Schroeder says is that there were men before Adam. They just didn't have a soul.
Right. So that would be... I'll talk about that a little bit more tomorrow, but that would be right. Meaning the singularity of man lies not in his physiological capacities and even in his intelligence.
And then Shema.
But it lies in the divine spark. And again, as Dr. Schroeder suggests... There may have been Homo sapiens identified as human beings, but God zapped 5,776 years ago. He chose one of those Homo sapiens and zapped him with a divine soul. And that is even the meaning of Adam is looking for a mate and could not find a mate. And God made woman. Now, what does that mean? Adam is looking to mate with a goose. I mean, what is Adam? What is Adam looking for?
He needs another soul.
No, but this is the answer.
How does he know there's another?
No, that's the thing. A minute ago, he saw men and women just like him.
Yeah.
But something happened, and he knows he's no longer them.
Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing thing. You wake up one morning and you look around all the people you knew all your life.
Everyone says,
and they're
it
not.
Happened to me once.
He's not them anymore. And that's why God said it is not good for this man to be alone. I will make him a helpmate with a divine soul. It's a very, very beautiful. But again, I think there are going to be textual kinks. It doesn't fit all of the verses as smoothly as one would like, but it's a very, very intriguing theory. And I say the word theory because these are speculations. I have to be honest with you. We don't have definite answers. That the creation of man is a celebration of his neshama, not his guf. The guf could have existed before.
Yeah.
in various forms. Okay? Because after all, what is man? Man is the soul. Now, the soul is not just your tool-making abilities. The soul is not even your technological abilities. But it refers to the divinity of being able to make choices of morality and goodness. Alrighty, we'll see you tomorrow. You have a good rest of the day.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.